Hello. Thank you, Shant. Should have switched it on before I plugged it into the back. This is not a deliberate Mr. Bean comedy attempt here. I was wanting to just say that it's amazing to see so many of you again. Haven't seen you in ages. And I've just spent a short bit of time talking to people around the place. And I realised that for some people, life's been a bit of a roller coaster in the last wee while, and it's been really tough. So I'm really sorry about that. But it's still my great privilege to come and share a little bit about Old Testament idols with you, and to hear a little bit more about what you think about that in today's service. So that's my hello, and thank you for having me back. I promised Martin Reed I think it was a few years ago, that I would not use paper for my sermons again, because paper is damaging the environment. And so I put most of my sermon onto my computer. Didn't seem totally right that it was all on digital format, so I put some of it in the back of a used envelope. I don't know if Martin's here. If I had to sum up what I'm going to say in just a sentence, it's that in the Old Testament, people were damaged by idols. They were damaged personally. They were damaged as a community. They damaged other people. And they damaged their relationship with God. And what I'm going to say today is that those same ways that those idols damaged people's relationship with God, with themselves, with their communities, can happen to us too. But I'm going to ask you to do something a wee bit painful. I know that this is a contentious issue after Andy coming up and telling us about the moving forward from that building into this part of the building. I'm going to ask you to move your seats. There's only two types of people who are exempt from moving your chair. One is if you actually physically can't get out of the chair easily. So you don't have to move if that's you. The other one is if you're an incredibly private person who reflects and gains information much better by being on your own or being in the comfortable chair that you're in. But if you are not that kind of person, I'm going to ask that everybody fills up this space. So where there are gaps in the chairs there, that all of that gets filled in your own time. Okay, next task for you is with the person to your left and to your right. And if you're on the end, sorry, you just have to go to the person on your right or to your left. So you can have a couple of conversations going here. I want you to just find out one thing about that person that you didn't know before. You have a very, very short amount of time to find this out. Go. Get something from Angus? Thank you. Okay, I think that'll do. Okay, guys, remember this is a church, not a social club. Right. Have a think now about the club you've been a member of. What's the most unusual club you've been a member of? Just think about this on your own. If you are so extrovert, you have to share it with someone else, then you can. But what's the most unusual club you've been a member of? Maybe that people in this place will not know about. Now I want you to think about the clothes that you're wearing. And which item of clothing that you're wearing right now is the oldest? Which item of clothing that you're wearing did you buy the longest time ago or was bought for you the longest time ago? And if you desperately have to share that with the person beside you, you can. Sure, it won't be underwear, but you never know. And now I want you to think about one thing you've got at home, one material item you've got at home, which you actually kind of don't need and that you could throw out today. Just one thing in your house that you could throw out today. One material item, and again, you can share it with yourself. I've just noticed someone pointing a finger at a person. There'll be some people who have tons of junk that could be thrown out. Some of you, I'm sure, live so frugally there is nothing. My challenge is, if you don't need that thing, maybe someone else could benefit from it, give it away. Or just throw it out, recycle it, upcycle it, do something like that with it. Old idols, idols in the Old Testament are described in 18 different ways in the Hebrew language. So there's about 18 different words in Hebrew which all talk about what an idol is, okay? And I would love to just stand here and tell you about all 18 of them, because I am fascinated by language and what things mean. And I could just probably sit away and think about that for ages. But I took the liberty of honing it down to the 7 most interesting that I could find. And I'm going to read them through to you. So that we start off by saying, what are we talking about when we talk about Old Testament idols? First word is teraphim. That means images or a family idol, and it's referred to in Joshua, Judges, and Hosea. So in Abraham's time, you would maybe have not just an idol that the whole community worshipped, but maybe just your family. So maybe like your family mascot, that kind of idol, very, very close thing to the family, but it would be an image, or maybe it would be a material object. The next word is matzeba. That would be a statue or a stone, and you find that referred to in Joshua, Samuel, Kings. And it's the same, matzeba is the same word to describe the statue of Baal, the kind of well-known god that was worshipped by people, the classic idol worship item. The statue of Baal was a matzeba. So whenever you see the word idol in the Bible, sometimes it could be one of these 18 different words, or one of the 7 I'm going to share. Another word is aven. And that means nothingness. In Isaiah, Deuteronomy, and Psalms, it's almost like people just investing in nothing, just kind of like, I'm pointing my whole life just towards sort of nothingness. And that would be an idol, actually, nothing as an idol. Next word was zelim, with a T at the start. And that was a shadow used in Daniel and in Samuel. And zelim, you know, like if you were to say, the idol is an image of, so maybe we have statue of the Virgin Mary. You could say that's meant to look like the Virgin Mary, and kind of almost, you can get one to size and you say, well, there you go, there is a statue. That's the likeness of the Virgin Mary. But this zelim is a shadow, so it doesn't even really look like it. So if I said, take a look at who's this person from the church, and I put a pic, just the shadow, the silhouette of the person, unless it was someone very distinctive, it'd be quite hard to tell who they were. So it's a kind of vague thing, zelim, shadow. Next one is atzab. And the root of that word is to fashion, to labour for. And really it means a wicked way of behaviour. In Isaiah, And in the Psalms, a wicked way of behaviour was regarded as an idol. So not just a material thing that you could hold, but actually a way of being and a way of living became the idol. A wicked way of behaviour. Next one is maskith. That's a device, an image of stone or something painted onto stone. In Leviticus and Numbers, maskith is described. So like I think of a device, I think of like a mobile phone. So maybe this was like a device. Maybe these were slightly smaller. Interestingly, that it's in Leviticus and Numbers at a time when people were building a tabernacle to try and contain the presence of God. There's a reference to not having a device, image of stone or a painted item that represented God. There was an idol that was a device, image of stone or painted. So maybe even like inside a cave, some sort of painting that people could go and get all their meaning and all their worth, and they would worship this image. Maybe that was something around about Leviticus time when the tabernacle was being built. They were aware, let's not make the wooden structure the thing that we worship. It's the God behind it. I don't know about that or not, but that's in my mind. And the final word that I found interesting was pesel or pesel. I'm pretty sure these pronunciations are a bit dodgy, but as if you're going to know the difference. But pesel meant graven or carved image. Graven or carved image. That's your classic one from Exodus 20, Ten Commandments. And it's maybe it's your first commandment or maybe it's the second commandment, depending on which one you think is the first. So pesel, a graven or carved image. So maybe that's something that you could carve yourself. You could make either a big thing or a small thing. But that became the place that you pointed your life towards, the place, the thing that you worshipped, where you got strength, wisdom, knowledge, your teleological, your spiritual being would be directed towards this carved or graven image. So by definition, idol is broad. We're not saying that there's just one thing that is idol. We can't just pin it down and say, that was the bad thing in the Old Testament. That's us, we've sorted out that. Thank goodness we don't do that anymore. Actually, it was very broad. There were lots of things that could represent idols. And maybe that's the same today. But there are some common points in all of those. Kind of one of the common points is that they didn't all claim to be the one true living God. And beyond that, they were typically all man-made, either man-made in imagination or in behaviours. There were man-made individual practices, or there were man-made community practices, or man-made family practices. Actually, one of the things that kind of combines a little bit of the atzab, the wicked way of behaviour, with the device, and it also combines the graven image, was the Moloch worshippers who had a bronze furnace. And in there, to get right, to be the right place spiritually, you could just incinerate somebody, human sacrifice. And so that's a kind of wicked way of behaviour, but it's using a device, and there's an image, there's all this stuff going on. So sometimes, actually, the idol was a combined thing. But anyway, so what? What does that mean for us? What's the point in actually looking at that today? You know, we are not in the Old Testament now. We are not the Israelites. So what is the relevance for us? All those idols asked humans to invest themselves in something that is not God. So are there things that we can invest ourselves in that's not God today? Maybe. In the Old Testament, the concept of idols seemed to be important, and it was referred to a lot. And I've chosen three passages from the Bible which I think reveal something about God's attitude towards idols. So in order for us to get from these are what the idols were to what does it mean for us, let's look at what some of the things that God said about them. And I'm going to give you three readings. First one is the Ten Commandments. I'll just read the very start. This is in Exodus chapter 20. And I think we'll just go from verses 1 to 4. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. And that's using the word pesel when it talks about carved image or likeness of anything in heaven. Next one is Psalm 115. And this is just the first 8 verses of that. Not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name give glory. For the sake of your steadfast love and your faithfulness. Just actually, that's verse 1 of Psalm 115. Like, we came here this morning and we began to sing songs together, praising God. And the start of this psalm says, not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name give glory, for the sake of your steadfast love and your faithfulness. That kind of reminds me why we do these songs together. Then goes on to say, why should the nations say, where is their God? Our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel. They have feet but do not walk, and they do not make a sound in their throat. Those who make them become like them, so do all who trust in them. And the last one is from 2 Kings chapter 10. Prepare yourself for this. This is an 18. If there's anybody under the age of 18, then hope you've been given permission to be in for this. 2 Kings chapter 10, verses 18 to 28. I'm going to read the whole thing through. Then Jehu assembled all the people and said to them, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu will serve him much. Now therefore, call to me all the prophets of Baal, all his worshippers and all his priests. Let none be missing, for I have a great sacrifice to offer Baal. Whoever is missing shall not live. But Jehu did it with cunning in order to destroy the worshippers of Baal. And Jehu ordered, sanctify a solemn assembly for Baal. So they proclaimed it, and Jehu sent throughout all of Israel, and all the worshippers of Baal came, so that there was not a man left who did not come. And they entered the house of Baal, and the house of Baal was filled from one end to the other. He said to him who was in charge of the wardrobe, bring out the vestments for all the worshippers of Baal. So he brought out the vestments for them. Then Jehu went into the house of Baal with Jehonadab and Rechab and said to the worshippers of Baal, search and see that there is no servant of the Lord here among you, but only the worshippers of Baal. Then they went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings. Now Jehu had stationed 80 men outside. The man who allows any of those whom I give into your hands to escape shall forfeit his life. So as soon as he had made an end of the offering and the burnt offering, Jehu said to the guard and to the officers, go in and strike them down. Let not a man escape. So when they put them to the sword, the guard and the officers cast them out and went into the inner room of the house of Baal, and they brought out the pillar that was in the house of Baal and burned it, and they demolished the pillar of Baal, and they demolished the house of Baal, and they made it a toilet to this day. Thus Jehu wiped out all of Baal from Israel. Is it just me, or does it seem as though God is not keen on idols? Seems as though God is not keen on people investing themselves in something that is not him. After looking at those root words in Hebrew, and after reflecting on those verses, I thought, why? Why might God want to steer us from idols? Why might there be a story where every person was slaughtered and the slaughtering soldiers were told, you too will be slaughtered if you don't kill them? And so I wrote down some of my thoughts as to why. And for each thought, I'm going to ask you to be very deliberate in considering whether it means anything to you, for your faith, for your life as someone who follows Jesus. And after each thought, I'm going to leave what could be regarded as an awkward silence of 30 seconds for you to contemplate in private. Or, as it seems to be the case with many of you, you can share it with the person beside you in your extroversion. So I'm going to run through my thoughts. You know there's going to be these 30-second gaps. That can be personal reflection, or it can be shared. The first reason that I wondered about as to why God is not keen on these idols is that idols are man-made. Man-made and so limited. We are finite, God is infinite. Maybe we are quite narrow. The person or the culture and the context of the idol has a limited intelligence, has a limited region, might be prejudice. Man-made idols may suit some and not others. Man-made idols may deliberately exclude. Man-made idols are inflexible, literally inflexible, like a big heavy statue to carry around or a painting in a cave. What if you don't live in the cave? They're kind of time-bound. They're inanimate. So they're man-made. During the Reformation, hundreds of pictures and statues of Christian holy sites were destroyed in this country. They were interpreted as being graven images or idols. Was that okay? Were statues of the Virgin Mary or paintings depicting the parables idols? And if they were, is that how we should behave now with perceived idols? Is that what IS are actually doing right now across the Middle East and beyond? I asked each of you to be flexible in moving your chair. And you did. Even though I did give exemptions, it seemed as though almost every chair was filled and people moved. So you're physically capable of moving, but is your faith flexible? Is it flexible enough to comprehend a living, moving, breathing God? Or is your Jesus static like the man-made statues? Told myself I'm not going to tell any hospital stories when I'm here because then it'll just be so boring. But flexibility reminds me of this patient who had faith in God and was diagnosed with a very serious illness and had a short time to live. The palliative care team knew that this man was not going to live longer than a week. The nurses on the ward knew he wasn't going to live longer than a week. Nor did his consultant, and nor did I expect him to live longer than a week. They had three young children, who are not so young that he couldn't communicate with. But he said, God is going to heal me and I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay. Because if God loves me, I'm going to be healed, surely. And you're the chaplain, so come on. Why would you even hint at questioning that? I'm not going to die. because God's good. I serve him faithfully, and I always have. And I brought my family up to do the same. And I asked him to reflect on, compared to 2 weeks ago, how is your health? By this point, he wasn't able to eat. Wasn't able to walk, go to the toilet himself. Time went on. I asked him, how has your health been in the last few days? He's now barely able to speak back. I floated the idea, could God still love us even in our pain and death? I'm going to be healed. Patient died and didn't say goodbye to his family or to his children. His faith wasn't flexible enough to know that God loved him even in extreme illness. I'm going to leave 30 seconds for you to think about your own personal faith flexibility. Second thought was that idols are impersonal. Idols are impersonal. You can neither know them nor can they know you. That to me is hugely important. Nor can they know you. The painting in the cave cannot know you. Deeper understanding of God and deeper understanding of yourself is not possible with an idol. An idol does not have a heartbeat. How, this morning, do we find ourselves coming to know God better? Do we always read the same authors, the same passages in the Bible? Do we sit in the same chairs? Do we always talk to the same people? Do we believe that God knows us? Do we believe that God knows us? That he truly knows us? And if you were just to scan your mind and allow yourself to think of the one most unacceptable part of yourself, so if you just let your mind do that, what part of me is the least acceptable? And then you're to clasp it in your hands, that part of you that's the least acceptable. Do you believe that what that is, and what's in there, is known by God? And that in Jesus, despite it, we are regarded as his treasured children, despite what's clasped there. Do we believe that God knows every person? That even they are accepted through the power of Jesus and his resurrection to life? That even us, West Glasgow New Church, are accepted? That even you are accepted as an individual? God promises us that we are. Idols don't even know we are there. I'll give you 30 seconds while I transfer onto the paper. I said that idols are impersonal. guess along with that is that they can't challenge us like an idol can't challenge us in response to something that we are doing because it doesn't know what we are doing. And in the same way, idols cannot be challenged. Actually, is that an important part of our faith? That we can challenge God and wrestle with Him? My other thought is that idols are small and shiny. And okay, you may have a really big bronze furnace, so it does not, but it's small cosmologically and sometimes physically too. And actually, in being small, an idol is powerless to help you. So therefore, all the time invested in idols is waste. Maybe the Yehus turning that temple into a latrine represented that in some way. All that time and energy and effort and presence and hope that you put into an idol is going nowhere because it is a nothing. It is a vain. It's just, it's nothingness. And compare that to Jesus, who says that even a cup of cold water, so he says, even a cup of cold water to the least of my followers does not go without reward. So the smallest tiny act of basic kindness, just a glass of cold water in God's name for His kingdom, does not go to waste at all. Whereas an entire life of worshipping an idol means nothing. So they're small. And shiny, well, they were made of shiny materials. Like, they kind of looked good. I think some of them were gold. They were made of materials that were regarded as precious to the time. But is God best represented by what's precious and prosperous now? Andy McNeish referred to a verse from Corinthians about treasures in a jar of clay. Not treasures in a golden, I can't even think of something, a receptacle that would be fancy that's made of gold. Golden casket. Do we make God small and shiny? Like, if we add the impersonal idol, like they don't know you, they're not a living thing with a heartbeat that can understand us. So that's the impersonal. And then the shiny, the what's prosperous in the day, in the moment, what's the flavour of the month, what's hot just now. If you take the impersonal and the small, could we say that science is that? Like right now, science is regarded as, you know, if you want money, if you, you know, let's say make a decision, we'll do it based on science. Is this provable? Yes. So therefore, it's worth making a decision. So that's the prosperous measure for the day. But you couldn't get any more impersonal because science says, well, scientifically, we'll benefit as a nation if we make people work until they're 75. That's scientific. That's impersonal, isn't it? So the impersonal and the shiny, the prosperous for the day, the thing that sounds good to the collective culture's wisdom of the day, multiplied by impersonal, is that what happens in apologetics? Science says, look, God's not real because this, this, and this, and it's not, nobody believes it nowadays anyway. So we say, okay, we'll try and we'll do that. We'll make God become shiny. We'll make Him the flavour of the month today. We'll try and make Him sound better, and actually we'll try and make Him impersonal too. Like, how do you define a relationship? What's the definition of a relationship? Qualitative data, heartbeat, you know, the intuition, all the stuff that goes along with God. Does a mystery get evaporated in apologetics? I'm just asking this, but is it possible that through trying to justify God, we make Him smaller and shinier than He really is? And what's the end point? We say, okay, here's God. He looks just like this. And he looks great, doesn't he? And I've got it, I've nailed it. It's sorted right here. Here's God. If we get to that point, is that really God? Idols were inaccessible to some people. Lots of idol worship came from the atzab. That's the doing, the verb, idol. And lots of it meant sometimes giving a human life for prosperity. Those with mental and physical challenges were often excluded by idols. And I just wonder, to whom are we inaccessible? Who do we exclude in our way of worshipping God? A theologian called Miriam Adeney spoke about a Chinese church in America who were challenged to be more accessible, who were challenged to be flexible, who were challenged to not let their culture and their practice of faith become an idol, because Chinese refugees had landed in America. Many people had died, and when they got there, they were caught. America was angry at them for coming over here. How dare you sneak in? China was angry at them. How dare you leave us? So they were left with no one. They were imprisoned, and in prison they became Christians. They heard the gospel message. And one of them went home to China and couldn't square living the life of a follower of Jesus with their current conditions. So they moved out to their uncle. This is a true story. With their uncle out to Ecuador, to a fishing village. And nobody there had ever heard of Jesus. And he said, I don't know if I'm actually equipped to tell all these people in this village. So there was Chinese American with a Chinese heritage church in Seattle, and they wrote to them and said, would you come and help teach these people about Jesus in Ecuador? And he said, well, hold on, we are American, we've got Chinese heritage, what have we got to do with Ecuador? What's that got to do with us? Like, accessibility of the gospel message is not a part our role. But they thought about it and prayed about it, and eventually they sent people over to Ecuador. So they were kind of like you moving your chair. They were probably slightly uncomfortable with that. But they went around to door to door and shop to shop. And now there is a church in this small Ecuadorian village which has, as of 5 years ago, 30 people. So now probably a million. But this was not something that can be achieved through idols, but through the living God and using living people who are moved to follow him. Just like the thing that you're going to throw out of your house when you get home. Idols wear out. Angus, sorry, you're going to have to throw something out today. You were really getting a lot of the finger pointed at you there. Just like the item you're going to throw out from your home. Materials fail. Culture moves on and things become irrelevant. In certain places now, if the Baal worshippers had not been completely wiped out in that moment, they would still be irrelevant anyway. A god of fertility in a time of GM crops, combine harvesters, pesticides. Well, I kind of don't need you Baal things very much, you know. Got a brand new combine harvester. We're told that God is immutable. He never changes, never fails. We're told that he's omnitemporal, he exists beyond time, so he's always culturally relevant. How do we show that to the people in Clevedon, Bears Den, Jordan Hill, White Inch? How do we show them that the God of the Old Testament, the God of West Glasgow, is relevant for you too? How do we do it? He speaks your language. And he has something to say to you. How do we do that? And finally, my last scrap of paper. Idols can be wielded. If you can make anything small enough to be held in your hand, it might have a fair weight and heft, and then can be used as a club. It can be used to strike others. Old Testament idols would charge access to statues, manipulate people for the gain of the select few. And we even saw this happening in Jerusalem when Jesus turned over the money lenders and the merchants from the temple who were selling things like dove offerings, like the cheapest, poorest person's offering, the one that cost the least, so they know the most vulnerable people needed it, but charging far more for it. We saw that becoming an idol, holding power over people, means people can be crushed. I actually believe that that behaviour was a type of idolatry which is known as Atsab. They developed a wicked way, a practice to exploit people. This was not about them facilitating people to come to God. This was about them making money. Is there anything at West Glasgow that we do that maybe unwittingly squashes people? Is there anything in our own lives for which we must seek reconciliation rather than intimidation, so that our faith isn't something to say, I'm better than you because I follow this, I do this, but rather I follow God and trust Him? So there's all these thoughts, there's all those verses, there's all this stuff. How do you sum it all up? Well, I don't know. But I was reading in part of my Bible earlier on in the week, which I came across when we did a game of two halves here, a sort of sports day for Tear Fund. And I came across a verse which I think speaks through all Old Testament idolatry, all modern day things that we can do and get caught up in the same ways as that, which I think is relevant and powerful and can keep us safe from it, and is worth pondering more about. So I'm going to read it to you, then I'm going to go. Micah 6:6. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with thousands of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. Amen.